It's going to be Sean Mine, contrary to what it says on the printed schedule. Sean's institutional affiliation is University of Florida, has been for several years. And as most of you know, he's been working on power systems in one way or another for at least 5 years.
About a decade, yeah. So,
and
yeah.
And this looks to me like it's in that same stream of work.
Yes.
Sean Mine.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. Yeah, thank you to the organizers and all the staff here. It's a pleasure to be at this beautiful place, this amazing institution, this beautiful location. As soon as I say that, it starts to rain. But but yes, this is work on how to deal with renewable energy. We're having there are problems all over the world today. In Germany, there's famous stories about the rapid integration of wind energy causing chaos. The Pacific Northwest, of the United States, is under incredible stress because of the very quick introduction of huge amounts of renewable energy, and it's a beautiful stochastic control problem. So I want to it's really going to be more of a tutorial. I'll spend half the time talking about the issues, and just maybe a third of the talk on mean field games and Markov decision theory. But it takes a while to explain the problem. So this is joint work with my colleague Prabir Barua at Florida, Anna Bucic, who's right here at INRIA, and our students listed there, Jordan Hehow and Yashin Lin. Actually, Hehow is now a postdoc at Berkeley. So it looks like a long talk, 57 slides. It's mainly pictures, so don't worry. The first part of this talk, the first three sections, really is just to really make sure you understand the problem. So I'm going to start off with a short quiz. And those of you who fail the quiz, I'm afraid you might as well just go, because it's just okay, so that's just basically, I'll check. It'll only take me a minute to check. And the trouble is usually two-thirds of the audience does fail the quiz, and it's not pretty, so sorry. I'm going to talk about the big control problem, how I can view regulating the grid exactly the same as regulating an airplane. I want to make that analogy first. And very quickly talk about how buildings can act as actuators. So people say storage is expensive, batteries are expensive. There's this dream of having plug-in electric cars everywhere because batteries are storage. Batteries are storage. You hear this over and over again. And it probably is not the future. You're sitting in the most fantastic battery in the world. Well, this is a huge thermal storage device. And you can ramp up and down the energy into the building, and the indoor quality won't change at all. So we have cheap batteries all over the world. It's a matter of how do you harness them. And pools will be another example of huge storage devices. Not for water, for energy. and so in the end, I'll talk about conclusions and suggestions. Some of you might be disappointed. I won't talk much about economics. That's definitely much more of a passion of mine, but this will be more in stochastic control. I'll mention some of the market issues as I go along. Okay, so a short quiz. So I ask, what's the value of power? And many people would say, well, let's look at prices to get an idea. And that might be an idea. So I mean, there's basically markets all over the world for power. If you look at the markets, you get an idea of what's the value of power. And here's a typical map of prices within the Midwest of the United States. And it shows prices pretty evenly around $68 a megawatt hour, which in the United States is very expensive. It's usually $30 or $40 a megawatt hour, which is why generators are almost out of business all the time. But this is what, Andy Warhol would love this. So this is prices day by day. Every 5 minutes, you'll have prices at $1,000 a megawatt hour. And then they'll go down to 800, and then down to 60, and then negative. So they'll go down to negative $500, and then up to 1,000. Every 5 minutes, they'll go crazy. So the dynamics of prices in the Midwest are absolutely beautiful. And so I'd love to have t-shirts made at some point. But is that the value of power? I don't know. I don't think so. but prices depend on time, location, and context. And it is true, the same is true of the value of power depends on time, location, and context. Obviously, a nuclear power plant on the North Pole would not be very valuable. So here's the quiz. So first, quiz question number one. So here's a typical trajectory of power from the northwestern United States. So it goes up to maybe 4 gigawatts, and it goes down to zero, over a period of 24 hours. And the price for power might be $20 a megawatt hour, might be constant over this day. And then you could ask, well, what's the value of this chunk of power, this energy? You know? And many people immediately say, well, it's 24 hours, and the average here was 1.6 gigawatts. So you just do a multiplication of three terms, and you get $750,000, which is still a lot of money, by the way. So anyway, that's the question, true or false, right? Is that the value of the power? You know, the price is $20 a megawatt hour, it's 24 hours, the average is 1.6 gigawatts, true or false? Is that the value of that energy of the day? All right, and so, you know, many people say true, and you probably think what I'm thinking, and you're wrong. You probably think you know what I'm thinking, but you're all wrong. Okay, so here's another trajectory of power. It's going negative and positive because it's a deviation in power. So there's a generator that's nominally putting out a gigawatt, but it's ramping up and down as well. And it's doing this just to play games, maybe, I don't know. But anyway, there's a power signal that looks like this. What's its value? Well, if you do the same calculation as before, the price was $20 a megawatt hour, and the average power is zero, well, you get a value of zero. True or false? So normally I would give you time to think about this. You know, I'd give you, you know, I'd be able to walk out of the room for 20 minutes and you could submit your answers, but I won't do that to you. I'll give you the answers, okay? I was just kidding. All right, so let's look at the first one. So is this true or false that if I've got this trajectory of power over a day, the price was always $20 a megawatt hour for every minute, it was an average of 1.6 gigawatts, true or false? One answer, true! Electricity is electricity. You know, gathered together, put it on the market, there it is, that's the value. And the analogy is like rice. You know, I've got a bunch of rice there, I go around with my bucket, put the rice in the bucket, take it to the market, you know, and there it goes. You know. So that's true, it's also false. Okay, so it's from a report in this region, the expected value of oversupply costs, so it's expected costs, that was their language. Is $12 million per year in this region, and with 300,000 megawatts of wind curtailment. So this is actually a negative value to the Pacific Northwest right now. Now, the point is that the first answer would be correct if we had infrastructure in place to deal with the volatility. You know, a rice field, what's the value of rice? Well, if you don't have a basket to put the rice in, the value is zero. And another analogy is cars. So did Henry Ford make, you know, his billions selling cars? No. He made money lobbying the government to build roads. You know, he knew he needed roads to sell cars. If the government hadn't built roads, he wouldn't have sold cars. And those are the baskets, for rice, or the infrastructure I want to talk about in this problem. We need infrastructure to deal with volatility, just like we need roads to drive cars. And what about this one? This is a lot of fun. So if you answered zero, you're right. If you've got an 800 megawatt disturbance with an 8 gigawatt load, you know, basically it's noise that will disappear from the inertia of the grid. That's a true answer in some contexts. But in this region, it's going to be false. I mean, you might guess it's going to, given the numbers they talked about, how expensive the volatility is in the Pacific Northwest, and given that high volatility, you'd guess it might be $500,000, but that's wrong. That number is ridiculously wrong, because this is not an arbitrary signal. This is the control signal from the Bonneville Power Authority, the region that regulates the grid in the Pacific Northwest. And so the value of that is like the value of the feedback loop in an airplane. So this is the showing the power in the Pacific Northwest in the United States. So you've got the hydro, which goes up and down. For various reasons, it ramps up and down. The reason it's so big is that a lot of the energy is exported to Canada. You've got load, which is very predictable, and you've got this nasty wind, you know, that goes up to 4 gigawatts, down to zero, up to 4 gigawatts, down to zero. Incredible memory, incredible nasty statistics. And because of that volatility that's introduced in the grid, there's disturbances that have to be rejected. And that disturbance is the control signal. And so the value of that is the Seattle economy, you know, and Portland and all the other places as well. If you got rid of that, crash, the grid would be gone. Okay? So this zero mean signal that has no value in terms of when you think of the analogy of rice or any other commodity, its value is infinite. It's the whole grid would disappear without it. So this little thing, which is only 10% of the of the market is infant value. Okay? All right, so that's the point. Okay, so generation from wind often exceeds the load in this region. It's amazing. All right, so I don't know. So that's the thing. It's a meaningless quiz. You know, the value completely depends on the context of the infrastructure available, just like a car. Okay, is that clear? So this is the thing I'd like to do. How do I understand this problem? How do I supply this regulation signal and so forth? Okay. So here's some extra credit questions in case you failed the quiz. So given that it has infinite value, what's the value of that? And what's the value of that? Quick. This and this, how are they related to that? Well, this plus this equals that. So those two guys, they have to be worth something, because you add them together, you get the Seattle economy. Okay? And the point is this signal put through a high-pass filter. So just taking the high-frequency component of this regulation signal. And this is the part, it's the low-frequency part. Yeah. And you add these together, you get this. And my proposition is that I want to take the pools to knock this out. The low-frequency component can be dealt with flexible loads like pools, like manufacturing. There are all sorts of flexible loads that can deal with low-frequency variations in power, as long as they're zero mean, you know, so that my overall activity is not not destroyed. So Alcoa is doing this today. I'll talk about that a bit later. They ramp up and down their consumption of energy, and they provide regulation service like this to the grid. This higher frequency can be obtained through other resources that I'll mention. Okay. With me? Okay, whoa, God, blew it. What's the value of this?
You already saw the answer.
Okay, so for those of you who didn't see the answer, what's the value of that, given this? They look identical?
But you saw the answer.
Right. So the value of this is minus infinity, because it's a delay of 10 minutes. And anyone, you know, who's been taking one control course knows that when you have delay in the feedback loop, it leads to instability. So even though these trajectories look identical, there's a delay, you blow up the grid. So it's a subtle problem. The value of power depends on the entire trajectory, and in a very subtle way. All right, so controlling the grid. So we've got the power grid, we all know what that is. And we have a control law, which is what the balancing authority or the independent service operator or, you know, there's a central authority that helps to manage all the resources and make decisions to control this grid, to stabilize it, and reject those disturbances that I showed you. And I want to explain to you what that is. You know, so the output is the power consumption and quality of life, and the input is the desires of the consumers and all these disturbances from nature. And I want to explain what that is, just briefly. Okay, so first of all, as we've seen, it's a very complex dynamical system. Supply and demand are volatile, and today supply is becoming more and more volatile. And traditional generators have very complex costs. That's another reason why it's hard to put values on power. And so what is this feedback loop? This is just describing the system. Well, again, we've got disturbances from nature, and you've got the desired power consumption. And I would think of if you subtract like the demand, if you look at the difference between the desired consumption and what's available, that's essentially like something like this regulation signal we've seen. So it's like there's an error signal. And in control, what you typically do is you pass this through usually a linear filter. Usually it's high gain at low frequencies. That's what control basically is. You take an error signal, you put it through a low-pass filter, and that's the input to the grid. And that really is what's happening. I mean, there's other things going on in constructing this regulation signal I won't talk about. But then, what is control? How do you realize this linear filter? Well, where it's realized today is you've got capacitors, gigantic capacitors, flywheels. You've got hydro, so dams, the water, the power from dams can be ramped up and down. It's a flexible power source. Batteries are used; they're very expensive. But flexible manufacturing is used today. So I mentioned Alcoa, an aluminum manufacturer. They ramp up and down their power to help to deal with this error signal. In India, I learned about a third of the power consumption is from brick baking. That's a very flexible energy consumer. That could easily help to regulate the grid in India. Water pumping is used a lot in California because water is pumped over the mountains from the east to the west, especially in Southern California. That's used in California to regulate the low frequency volatility. So all of these are actually would be like actuators in the control system.
More efficient than the other?
More efficient. Efficiency is hard, actually. One of my joke questions at the end is define efficiency. It's very hard to explain what that means. But hydro, I always thought the Pacific Northwest had it made, because hydro is trivial. They've got 8 gigawatts of, or more, 12 gigawatts of capacity of power of production, and why not just ramp it down to zero, ramp it up to 12 and down? You kill the fish. The salmon die. There's a real constraints on the rate at which you can release it. You've got oversupply of wind. The dams fill up. You're in big trouble. You know, it's like a battery filling up. Your basket of rice fills up. The constraints are, it turns out the hydro is not nearly as valuable as you think, but it has a lot of value. I think flexible manufacturing in the future will be much more valuable, is my guess. You know, there's so much of it. It's a hard question to answer. But how do we harness these actuators? And here's where I have to make a dig about, there's an economic point of view that really is harmful right now. Right now, you know, there's an assumption that we have to have prices to devices. So when you go to the power systems work conferences, Terry Boston, who's the CEO for the biggest utility company in the US, was screaming that prices to devices are coming our way and we better get ready. He was saying that last year. This year I was at the power systems meeting, and somebody from the New England ISO was almost crying because they were told they have to accept these new standards for loads, so that price signals will go to a load, and depending on how high the price is, the device will shut down or turn on, because the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is really pushing this. They really want it. There's a lot of lobbying that's going on, and there's a lot of really idealistic thinking that's in the academic community as well. And I say no chance this will work. There's never been a single simulation experiment that's backed this up. The Pacific Northwest National Labs tried to experiment in the Olympia Peninsula. It failed. They gave up. The New England ISO tried prices, you know, the same sort of thing recently to try to, you know, have auctions in real time for prices, to regulate the grid, essentially. It failed. They shut it down in a few months. And so why do we do this when we know that this is a control problem? There are market issues that are very, very important we should study, but this is a regulation problem that we know how to solve. You know? And once we know how to solve that regulation problem, that is like the social planner's problem of economics. So when you study the efficiency of a market, you first look at what would Peter Kokotovich do? That's a wonderful control theorist from Illinois. What's the social planner's problem? If you were a benevolent dictator like Peter was, what would that person do? And then you see, does the market realize that ultimate goal? Okay? So even if I believed that Milton Friedman would solve this control problem, I would first see what Peter Kokotovich would do, and then see if the market realized Peter Kokotovich's dream. Right, some selected prior work. So demand-side management's been used by utilities forever, since the beginning of time, and mainly for emergency response, almost exclusively for emergency response until recently. The history behind all the push towards prices to devices, you know, that again, you have a price signal going to your water heater. When the price gets high enough, the water heater turns off. That's due to Fred Schweppe. So he had papers in the late 70s and a book. And this paper, which is very a paper that's very highly cited in 1980, where in the abstract he says that they're going to solve this regulation problem that I've described. And in very vague terms, he says, through economic principles, through an energy marketplace, using time-varying spot prices. So this was in his book and papers, and it really caught the imagination of people, and it just hasn't left. So more recently, there's been work on the control problem. Let's just go back to basics, get an inventory on what flexible resources are available and how you would harness them for control. And I'd say that, you know, Anderson in Zurich and Callaway and Hiskins, and the student John Matthew, who just graduated, they've done some of the nicest work on trying to understand how you harness flexible loads like water heaters. You know, looking at the control problem, and a bit on the market side as well. I'm pointing out that there are real dangers to price signals for control. The difference in this work is, first of all, this it seems pretty trivial, but the idea of taking the regulation signal, break it into bandwidths, and sending the signal to different resources depending on the bandwidth, believe it or not, it's a new idea. And I think it's a very useful way of viewing this problem. A big difference with prior work is that the intelligence is placed in the loads. So that's the joke about intelligent pools, is that, time goes fast. That if you put a lot of intelligence at the nodes, then you need less intelligence at the grid level. And there'll be an aggregate model for control by the balancing authority. You spend a lot of time designing the control at the nodes of the graph so that you have an easier control problem at the grid level. And that's when you get a mean field model for the system. Okay. Now, I don't have time to say much about this. I mean, I think it's just useful to say for the high frequency component of the regulation signal in BPA, I firmly believe they could handle that today. I mean, if they could harness the buildings in Seattle and Portland, all the commercial buildings in the region, they could just knock it out. Absolutely. I strongly believe that. And nobody would feel a thing. So I'm not going to go through the details. So just, I mean, heating, ventilation, air conditioning. HVAC is heating, ventilation, air conditioning. It consumes 40% of electricity in the US. And there's enormous thermal capacity in a building. And just think to yourselves. I mean, if the fan turned off for 10 minutes and then turned on and then off, do you think you'd feel anything? The only issue might be noise. And buildings today have very responsive equipment, so motors that can ramp up, ramp down, ramp up, ramp down. You know, they're designed to do that. And so I'm not going to go through. I'm going to forget it. I'm going to forget the details. I'm just going to show you some results. So basically, you take a regulation signal, you put it through a bandpass filter, and you modulate the fans up and down. You know? So the regulation signal says, consume more power, you consume more power. They say, consume less power, you consume less power. So you ramp up, ramp down, ramp up. The main innovation here is figuring out what frequency range is going to work. And there are a few issues. I mean, one is you don't want to destroy the motors. Super high frequency is going to kill the motors. So you have to worry about that. Super low frequency is an issue. Because if you turned off the fan for 20 minutes, the control system in the building would, you know, somewhere else would start to ramp up power. And you'd end up, there'd be a fight between the control system in the building and your system. So if you stick to a moderate frequency range, you avoid that conflict. And I guess I should go back there. I mean, if you stick to a certain frequency range, then the control system in the building doesn't see the disturbances at all. If it's high frequency enough, then there's no impact at all.
John, yeah. There seems to be something implicitly linear in all your thinking so far. Is that realistic or not?
Well, yes, it is, because of the fact that we're looking at small deviations. So basically, in this building, we've got a 25 kilowatt motor, and we're only going to be adjusting it up and down by 10%. You know, and so in that range, a linear model is beautiful.
The signal you're trying to decompose is some kind of global signal,
yeah.
And you want to have the reaction happening locally.
Yeah.
There's some fairly extensive mapping between the global and the local,
yeah.
Which might not be so linear.
Well, that's the thing. It's very similar to what's done today, though. So in the Pacific Northwest, you've got distributed resources, all the generators are keeping back 10% of the capacity so they can ramp up and down. So really that distributed nature of supplying the regulation signals done today. And so the only difference here is there's more of them. And I think that could be a good thing. You know, it could actually be easier. So, you know. But the thing is that to get 10 kilowatts of regulation up in, you know, plus or minus 10 kilowatts from this one building only results in a deviation of 0.2 degrees centigrade in that building. So it's no effect at all. And no effect on carbon dioxide. So no effect on indoor quality at all. And it's 10 kilowatts. There are 100 buildings in Florida, so they can supply a megawatt of ancillary service. The state of Florida, we worked out, could supply all the regulation needs of the entire eastern US in this frequency band, which is about half the power. And that's just the fans. The chillers are the big energy consumers in commercial buildings, and we've worked on that as well. And you can get a wider range of frequency regulation from chillers and the same sort of thing. It's a bit harder, actually, but you can get up to an hour, so periods of an hour from chillers in commercial buildings. And so that would knock out everything in this. In this frequency band, commercial buildings in the U.S. would knock out. You probably could get 40% renewable energy in most of the U.S. And deal with that part of the frequency band of the disturbances, the buildings alone. That I really believe. Okay. Commercial buildings alone. Okay. And no impact on indoor quality. All right, but you want to hear some, you want to hear about the pools, I know. That's why you're all here. So.
You mean real pools?
Yeah.
Actual swimming pools.
Yeah, you're going to like this.
More abstract.
No, the dogs and fleas here are real, as are the frogs and algae. So, first of all, we've got this beautiful resource. In Florida, you've got, in California, it's even worse, Mike. In Florida, there's a million pools consuming a gigawatt of electricity. And Florida Power and Light has their hands on the switch of 80% of them. They've already got contracts with consumers to shut down their power in the case of a hurricane. So the contract is that 3 or 4 times at max, I can shut off your pool pump in the case of some disaster. So a lightning strike or hurricane knocks out part of the grid, Florida Power and Light shuts down the pool. Yeah, but that's the thing, they've got their hands on the switch, and so we can try to convince them to play with it a bit more. Okay, so they've got...
It's not tied in with the NSA.
Yeah, well...
I'm okay.
Yeah, well, we're going to get to that. So, exactly. So, pool pumps, again, they use like 1.3 kilowatts of power. There's a million in Florida. That's a lot of power. They run 6 to 12 hours per day, 7 days a week. Pool owners are oblivious until they see frogs and algae. And their privacy concerns, they don't trust the NSA. And I don't trust you anywhere, my name is Mike. I had a suspicion he was reading my email. They don't trust, no way they trust utilities. I mean, and there's been studies done on this. You know, consumers do not trust utility companies. So in terms of dealing with this, I mean, privacy is a big issue, and so is a smooth behavior, the aggregate behavior. So randomization is a key here. And so it's just like in the internet, PIP protocols have randomized backoff to avoid synchronization. And that's what I'm concerned about here. I mean, I don't want price signals, for sure, because price gets high enough, all those pools shut off at once, a gigawatt turns off, the grid blows up. So synchronization is a big deal. So randomization is important. And I want minimal communication. The people don't want the grid operators to be looking at what their pool is doing all the time. So the pool has some cognition. It knows what the needs of the grid are. And it wants to know about the pool under its care. It wants to look for frogs and algae. So the only thing the pool knows is how much cleaning have I done, and a signal that we can all see today, the regulation signal from the grid, okay. Or something like it. All right, so now, frogs and algae and dogs and fleas. So we need a randomized policy. How would we realize a randomized policy? That's the question. So what's a good class of randomized control laws to solve this problem? The way to think about it is this. So let's pretend that the nominal behavior of pool owners is randomized already. That basically, if I've been off for 1 hour, it's very unlikely I'll turn on. As I'm on for longer and longer and longer, it's more likely they'll turn on. So I'm going to start off with the Markovian model for a single pool. It's not completely realistic. Everyone today has deterministic strategies. I'm on for 8 hours, off for 14, but 16. But let's just take this as a starting point. And the control transition matrix, I'll denote P with a check on it. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to deviate the nominal behavior, and there'll be a cost for doing so. So the cost function I'm going to have in an individual pool is that there's going to be some needs of the grid and some deviation from nominal behavior. Okay, so I'm going to model that is I'm going to have a parameter z, which can be positive or negative, times power consumption, and then plus at some sort of distance function between p check and p, the cost for deviation, and this is either a cost or a value for power consumption. So if z is positive, then there's a reward for consuming power. So power consumption you expect to go up if z is positive. If z is negative, there's a cost for power consumption, you expect it to go down. And we have to determine how we can actually come up with formulas. You know, we have to do some math eventually. All right, so how are we going to come up with these cost functions? Well, for the needs of the grid, I'm going to call cap of x the indicator function the pool is off, you know, given the state x. Okay? So remember, the state could be either off or you could be on. And that's like proportional to negative power consumption. You know? For a pool, the old-fashioned pool pumps that are either on or off. I mean, there are variable speed drive pool pumps today. And so then we might have a more refined model. But let's just stick to a simple model for now. Okay, that's just a simple cost function. And then in terms of the distance from nodal behavior, it turns out relative entropy is a really nice choice. It's appealing in a lot of ways. You know, it looks locally quadratic in a nice form. It's a weighted quadratic, is the way it looks locally. It has a lot of nice properties, as we'll see. Okay, so there's engineering reasons to choose this for sure. And it's not bad, you know. And some of you know why. But yeah, so Venkat knows why. Okay, here's why. So for a given state x of the Markov chain, my cost is z times cap of x, the indicator function off, plus the relative entropy between the distribution with the new model and the distribution of the nominal model. And if pi check denotes the invariant probability measure for p check, the average cost will just be the average of this over x, and just denoting that by, you know, pi check dot kappa is just the mean of kappa. And when you average that over x, you get something that's called the Donsker-Verdon-Reed function, okay, which some of you have seen before. So the Donsker-Verdon-Reed function here is the average of the relative entropy that I had before. So that's the relative entropy that I defined. And that's the average over p check. When you prove Sanov's theorem for Markov chains, that's the rate function. So there's a huge amount of theory around this. So, Todorov didn't know about large deviations, but he guessed this would be a nice form for a cost function in optimal control. And he showed that when you solve the average cost optimal control problem with this particular cost function, you get a linear problem to solve for the average cost optimality equations become sort of trivial in a sense. That's a beautiful fact. Okay. So that's the real reason this was chosen, that the solution to the optimal control problem becomes so straightforward. Okay. So I'm going to explain that eigenvector problem, and I bet I have more than 10 minutes, don't I?
No, you have 10 minutes.
No, I won't. Come on, I have more than 10 minutes.
Yeah, right? Schedule.
You've been reading my email. Come on.
Yeah, I'm sitting right next to power.
There's market power here. I've got the power right here. So anyway, I'm going to rely on your kindness, Mike. Just a couple extra minutes. So this is a scale transition matrix you can define. So I have the nominal matrix, and I scale it by e to the minus z kappa, where kappa is my cost function. And there's the eigenvector problem. PV equals lambda v, where lambda is the eigenvalue. And lambda turns out to be e to the minus cost. Eta star is the average cost. And V you have to solve. So you have to solve this eigenvector problem. But you know the eigenvalue, so it makes it even easier. I mean, if you know the average cost, of course. But still, you can just solve this for every lambda. You know, that's the idea. And then the optimizer is this twisted transition matrix. Okay? So that's the twisted transition matrix that comes up in large deviations from Markov chains. So it's a well-studied object. In fact, it was the obsession for my life for at least 10 years with Yannis Kantianis, who's at Athens. So this is something I've studied a lot. That's the solution to a single pool. Okay. And I'll show you some numerics in a moment. I've got time. Okay, so that's the individual pool. Now, what about the mean field model that's been talked about in other lectures? For the accurate model, I'm going to let y of t denote the proportion of pools that are off. That's consistent with my cost function, kappa. And if every pool operates according to p check z, z is constant for now, then y of t would be approximately the steady state cost, you know, with respect to this new probability measure for large t. So I'm appealing to the law of large numbers, I'm averaging a million pools, and I'm appealing to the ergodic theorem that I've settled down to steady state. And so again, with fixed z, If you wanted to understand the transient behavior, you'd have an initial distribution mu zero of the pool states, and you'd look at the T-step transition matrix, the new model, and that would give you the evolution, the transient evolution. And we could start, you know, study the rate of convergence and all that. Forget that. What we really have is a time-varying signal. You know, we have a signal with very little structure. You know, maybe we've put it through a bandpass filter. That's all we've got. And we really want to be able to interpret ZI as a control signal that's broadcast at the grid level by a balancing authority and understand that. And that's where things appear to get ugly, but they actually get prettier, believe it or not. It's a time-varying Markov chain, but it's very pretty. Okay, so ZI is a control signal that's broadcast by a balancing authority, a grid operator, and we want to know how to choose it. So the evolution of the state is hideous. It's a non-homogeneous Markov chain. So the state at time t is now a sum of products of pz0, pz1, pz2. It's a complete mess. This is when you run out of the room. All right? There's no theory for non-homogeneous Markov chains like this. The average number of pools that are operating or not operating is given by this mean as before. And that's what I'll assume that the grid operator estimates or knows somehow. They know how many pools are on or off. Maybe either it's an estimation problem of some sort. That's the only information at the grid level. And so mu t is going to be viewed as a state process that's under our control and the grid level through zt, that's the control that's sent out, with observations yt. Okay. So that's the mean field model, the nonlinear Markov process that Sasha talked about, is this model here. And so if z depends on mu, so z naught depends on mu naught, that's why it becomes nonlinear. Okay. So we can't even use any kind of Markov theory. So how do we control this complex nonlinear system in just 5 minutes? Well, we've got a million pools with input zt and output yt, which is the proportion of pools that are off. And we have this nonlinear evolution of the state. And again, I just want to make sure you all understand, you've got yt is what's measured at the grid level. There's a yt desire, basically, which would be some function of the disturbance that we're trying to reject, or the regulation signal we're trying to track. And that goes into the grid, and you get this feedback loop. And how on earth do you design this function from the observations to the regulation signal? Well, here's where we get lucky. So again, it's a nonlinear system, so good luck. But if ZI is small, and if your initial distribution is close to the, to pi, the steady state, the nominal steady state, then you can replace p-check by its linearization and get a pretty good approximation. And this model turns out really a nice, tight approximation. Okay. And if I replace mu t by pi, that's why I've gone from here to here in approximation. All right. So basically, I'm just doing a Taylor series expansion to go from here to here. And look at that. So delta, there's a formula for it based on Poisson's equation. Poisson's equation is behind all of your talk, I know. It's everywhere. But there's a very pretty formula for the derivative that I've studied for quite a few years with Kavianis. And it comes up in risk-sensitive control as well. So we know what delta is. And what does it look like in this model? Okay, so we've got a linear state space model. The new distribution is a linear function of the old distribution plus a linear function of the control. What does it look like? So control should be easy if it's a nice linear system. So the only way to say anything now is to do a numerical example. I'm going to come up with a particular choice for P. And I'm going to take this nominal model where basically, if I'm off, my probability of turning on is basically almost zero for the first 12 hours, then it's almost one for the next 12 hours. So my nominal behavior is a symmetric model where I'm basically almost periodic with a period of 12 hours with a little bit of probability of switching. Okay? And for each Z, P check Z will have a similar function like this. It'll have the same the graph associated with P check will be the same as P, so you're only going to be changing these probabilities of turning on. Okay. So if I've been on for 2 hours, off for 2 hours, there's a probability of turning on, and those P's will change in the twisted transition matrix.
Sean, is this purple graph a picture of a model input or a model output?
No, the choice for P, oh yeah, so again, let me just say this again. So if I've been off for 2 hours, there's a probability of turning on, And that's right here, this two, that's the probability of turning on. Okay? And if I've been on for 11 hours, my probability of off, for 11 hours, my probability of turning on is about 1/10.
Right, right. Yeah. And again, is that
that's the nominal model. That's a P. That's the normal behavior if
so that's a kind of default control
yeah.
to be improved upon.
That's right.
Got it.
So in my control problem, I had a nominal model. That's a nominal model. Now, it turns out the twisted model has this very strange behavior. I mean, as you increase Z, the probability of turning on increases as you'd expect. In a nice smooth way initially, and then you get this strange behavior. I can't explain it. So, but you get a nice linear approximation for small z, and then a very strange behavior for larger z. When z is up to 6, it's basically probably of 1 of turning on. Okay. And if you look at the linear approximations you get from theory of from large deviation theory, there's a quadratic approximation for the average cost, and it's almost dead on right between, say, minus 4 and 4. You know, the quadratic approximation is excellent for the average cost. There's an approximation of the steady state probability that a pool is operating, which is linear in z, and that's also just beautifully tight for z between, say, minus 3 and 3. So the linear approximations that come from large deviations theory are really valuable here. And so you'd think that maybe my linear approximation for control is going to be pretty good. And there it is. So in this particular example. Now, the most important thing is that this linear model is minimum phase. And if you've taken a control course, then you know, then your heart is thumping right now. I mean, because minimum phase is gold. It's like if you get an optimization problem, you find it's convex, you say, I've solved the problem, call Stephen Boyd at Stanford, and you go home. You know, if a control problem is minimum phase, then it's trivial, according to control theorists. You know. Of course, just like some convex problems are incredibly hard, obviously. But minimum phase is a good thing, especially if it's a low-order system. And if you look at the solidarity of the linear and nonlinear models, this is a swept sine input. So I've got an input which is going up and down with increasing frequency. You can hardly tell the difference between the Markovian model and its linear approximation. This is a pretty small values of z, between minus 0.3 and 0.3, but in even a broader range, it's pretty tight. Okay, so what about a simple control law? So I have to change the problem slightly to make this work, because if the ISO sends out a signal every hour, and a disturbance comes at 5 minutes past the hour, they have to wait 55 minutes for response. That's ridiculous. You've got all these pools sitting around. Why shouldn't they do something? So basically, what I'm going to do is I'm going to have the pools check every half hour. You know, it's every hour. That's no big deal. But let's say they don't have a common clock. Okay. So one pool checks at 5 past. Another collection of pools checks at 10 past. Another at 15 past. So they don't have the same. They each check every half hour, but they don't all check at noon, all check at 12:30, all check at 1. And this way, you get rid of that delay. So the ISO sends out a signal. There are a bunch of pools that can respond. And then when you get rid of that delay, simple control laws work. And PI control seemed to be the best thing. We tried using optimal control, and it just wasn't any better. So PI control was fine. So that means that I have an error signal, y desired minus y. And I have a gain times the error plus another gain times the integral of that error, just the sum of the error. That's PI control in discrete time. And you can see why for the linear model, this knocks it dead. And for the Markovian model, it does as well. So when you actually apply the PI controller to a Markovian model, this is the actual nonlinear model. So I'm applying a linear PI controller to the Markovian model I would get, the mean field Markovian model. I get perfect tracking of this BPA regulation signal in this region. And this is real. So this is assuming a million pools of a kilowatt each, you know, operating according to the scheme. If you could only get a wire from Florida to the Pacific Northwest, you could knock out this entire part of the regulation signal. That's the problem, of course. And so this would be very valuable in California, much more, because you do have power. You do have transmission there. OK, so that's an end of it. I mean, this is just, I can't explain why it works so well, except numerically, the linearizations are very tight. So in terms of there's a great playground for control theory. And in terms of open problems, the network issues I haven't talked about, that needs can be regional. There can be transmission constraints locally. And that might mean we should have a communication architecture that consists of local voltage signals and a global signal as well. There's a consumer risk. On average, the quality of service is perfect in this model. But for one pool, frogs and algae. Right? Yeah, so it's going to happen. The law of large numbers doesn't mean everybody's happy. There'll be one pool owner who doesn't get good service. And for grid level risk, I don't see any yet. Okay, and so that deserves further study. The biggest issue is economics. How are you going to get these resources? I mean, they're sitting there waiting to be used. How are we going to get them? And the biggest thing is contracts have to be employed, as is done today for Alcoa and in other and in Florida. And so contract design is the biggest issue in realizing these services. And they're successful contracts today everywhere. Their papers say there are efficiency losses with these long-term contracts. Yves Smears has a nice paper on this. But extra credit to find what that means. What's efficiency? You know, I mean, there's reliability, cost trade-offs that are very complex. And we need smart appliances, whatever, to facilitate these contracts. And control theory to make it work, because there's not a control, there's not a power engineer alive who could explain why the grid is so robust today. It's an incredibly complex decentralized control problem. There's no theory to back it up, why it's stable today. It's nothing. You know, why you could have local controls at nodes all over Europe, and yet the whole system's stable. It's not. So we need policy to get this going, just like we need somebody to lobby to get the roads. We need somebody to lobby to get these resources in place. And that's about it. Thank you.
I have a question. You're considering, if I understood well, the optimization problem for the mean field limit of your system.
Yeah.
Do you have any result of the convergence of the optimal schemes for fixing to this optimal scheme? The convergence of the optimal.
I mean, the rate of the convergence. Yes. I mean, I can just basically steal from a recent paper of Vivek Borkar. So the convergence to the mean field model is, I don't think, hard given the.
The convergence of the optimal policy for a given end to the optimal policy optimal scheme that you are using for the.
We haven't looked at that now. I mean, yeah, because we have. In fact, I tried optimal control.
It could be a question that your optimal control is irrelevant in the limit.
Possibly. Yeah. I don't know. We haven't looked at that though.
More questions? Yes.
Is local and domestic generation used in the United States, solar power on the roof?
Well, it's shocking. You know, New Jersey has much more solar than Florida. it all depends on policy. You know, it's remarkable how little push there's been in some parts of the U.S.
So you would need to do something similar from the generation side as well.
Here's the problem. Everything is there. I mean. What's stopping us is this. What's the policy in Florida? Florida Power and Light, if they spend money, they can lobby for rate increase. So what are they doing right now? They're spending $3 billion on natural gas plants so they can lobby the government for rate increases. You know, it's just because the incentives are backwards today. You know, and so policy is the biggest issue. And so, in the opposite corner of the country, you had equally naive policy, where they just said, "We'll allow you to dump your wind into the grid for life, and we'll never curtail you." They said that, and now they've got 4 gigawatts of wind. They don't know what to deal with. So policy is the biggest issue in a way. It's the hardest problem. I don't know if I did I answer your question.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Let's thank Sean again.